I want to know who manufactured this gun. Now, for some reason, it doesn't seem to be any reporting about that. All the big gun manufacturers have their version of an AR-15. But I want to know who specifically did this one. I want to be able to send the CEO a card saying, congratulations on your weapon doing such a good job at shredding these high school students. Congratulations on your weapon doing such a good job in killing that toddler. Congratulations on your weapon being able to rip apart the vital organs of that football coach at the high school, of that sociology teacher. I'd like to be able to send a card to the members of the board of directors of that company and just compliment them. Compliment them on the quality of their product.
It's Friday, February 16th, 2018. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kev Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week I talk to our Capitol muckraker in chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. On today's show, more tributes and sacrifices made to the gods Vulcan and Moloch this week, as AR-15 armed 19-year-olds slaughters 17 in Parkland, Florida. More evidence that unregulated free market capitalism produces the best products on the market. I'm with Sam Cedar on this one. I'm sending thank you cards to gun manufacturers, CEOs, and boards of directors. Suggest you do the same. Janus versus AFSCME slated to steamroll public sector unions in Supreme Court case. That will be argued on February 26th. Protests and rallies are being called for on February 24th across the country to protest the Janus case. News flash to my brothers and sisters in the labor movement. Business unionism, closed doors negotiations, and hoping for the best is not going to stave off the wrecking ball. Organize or go home. I think our options are limited to those. Failed presidential candidate Mitt Romney throws in his hat for the Utah Senate race. You know, the guy who thinks half of American people are lazy freeloaders. PA gerrymandering case heats up as Governor Wolf rejects redrawn GOP maps and the PA House Democratic Caucus releases its own maps. Last night at midnight was the deadline. Ding dong. What will the Supreme Court do in Pennsylvania? We don't know. But Senator Scarnati says he has not ruled out impeachment of the PA Supremes. Keep holding on there, man. Keep holding on. Oh, sorry. It just drives me crazy. The PA GOP, meanwhile, officially hitches its wagon to alt-right candidates. There you go. Just so everybody's clear now, there's no question they've done it. Yes, we endorse the alt-right candidates. There you go. But on the other side of the aisle, PA retiring House Democratic leadership wants their sons to take over their seats. Yeah, there's no corruption in PA, folks. Howard Bunces, the author of the Bunces Report, analyzing the finances of Kutztown University and Pashi. He was at Kutztown University yesterday to discuss his report. Oh, so much I got to say about that, but I'll hold off. And the first medical marijuana dispensaries finally open up across PA. In today's last call, are you ready for the Galactic Gilded Age? Call them space barons, call them space pirates, or captains of space industry. Whatever you call them, billionaires are rewriting our space policy. Free Will Brewing? Ooh, man, they just released the orange-colored Malcontent, a double IPA with Cara oranges. That comes in at 9.5%. I am so excited. I'm going to pick some of those up today after the podcast. On this Sunday at Free Will, they're going to be hosting their Barrel Age Tap Takeover. If that were not enough, the Bread Box and Bakery right here in Perkasie has teamed up with Free Will and making beer bread. Beer bread, right? You'll have to wait until Wednesday, however, if you want to get your hands on some of that, for that's their next release. This week's bake is all gone. And I paid a visit to Saucony Creek for lunch yesterday. Didn't have any beer, but man, the food was freaking awesome. And that Pizza Boy Berliner Weiss that we've been talking about is canned and ready for you. I want to remind everybody to tune in to the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org. You can also tune in on the Dish Network, DirecTV, or through the Free Speech TV app on Roku. And I want to let everybody know that Rick just launched his Patreon page. You can go to patreon.com/RickSmithShow, all one word, Rick Smith Show, to become a member and support the only radio, labor radio and TV show grown right here in PA. If you missed the show, check out the archive. All of Rick's shows are now archived at Free Speech TV. Just go to Free Speech TV or freespeech.org and search for their shows, and you'll see Rick Smith shows there. Boom. All the archives are right there. And this guy right here, I'm even in some of them. You know, they're for the Resistance Report once in a while. I want to give a huge shout out to Will. Will made a kind of generous donation to Raging Chicken Press this week. Thank you so much, Will, for your donation. And if you like what you can hear, be like Will, man. I think it's a good slogan. Be like Will, right? You want to support Pull No Punches, Progressive Media? Become a member of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. If you're not ready to become a member, no problem. Just be like Will and make a one-time donation by going to ragingchickenpress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab. Click Donate, you'll be on your way. Or be like Will and stop by my office and hand me cash. I'm all for that. That's fine, too, as well. I want to remember that we are in the closing days of our Winter 2018 Membership Special. Now through the end of February, you can get your own copy of Steven Singer's book, Gadfly on the Wall, A Public School Teacher Speaks Out on Racism and Reform, by joining at the $10 a month level. So join up, folks. Be like Will, man. Just be like Will. So, Sean, man, here we are in the midst of, more chaos, storm, 70-degree weather, and all sorts of insanity across the state and the country. Man, it feels like old times.
Yeah, you know, one thing that's going to save me, it's going to be my Blue Apron food box that I'm going to be getting from the government on a weekly basis.
That's the best solution possible, right?
Yeah, I can't believe we forgot to talk about that in the show notes, but yes. Have you seen Trump's plan to replace the food stamp program with the Blue Apron idea?
I did not see the plan. I heard about this. I did not see the plan, but
I don't know if you're happy or if you're upset if you're the people at Blue Apron this week for all the free advertising you're getting from media sources.
I know, right? I mean, if you're Blue Apron, you're like, okay, they want to give us all this business, but meanwhile, like, we've got, you know, subscribers bailing on us like left and right now because Trump has now tied his wagon to that.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. That's just incredible. Why don't we just send them food directly?
You know, for people who hate big government.
Oh, man. Well, that's not big government. It's a big corporation. The government would just, you know, foot the bill, apparently. I don't know. Or maybe make the poor people actually have to work it off in some sort of, like, you know, work program.
Amazon plant.
Yeah, the Amazon plant, which, by the way, now that we know from last week's show, they're going to be able to get their own health insurance right through Amazon, right at the company store, man.
Yeah.
You can't get any better than that, I guess. But, man, it's just crazy. It's crazy. But, man, so I guess right off the top of the bat, we should talk a little bit about another freaking mass slaughter, right? I don't know, man. I was moved. It's funny because I was you heard in the intro today. There's a little segment from an extended segment. I get it, folks. Like, for you're sitting there, man, why aren't I going to come back? Why is this so long? But. You know, this is something Sam Cedar was addressing on the Majority Report this week, and it wasn't in the segment that you heard, but he started talking at one point about this god Moloch, right? And Moloch is, you know, kind of biblical, all this kind of stuff, and it was about the god of child sacrifice, right? And it's funny he mentioned that because what was going through my head, I don't know. Sean, have you ever seen any of the show American Gods by any chance?
I have not, no.
Right. It's a Showtime show, and they just released some of the stuff on like Amazon and things like this. And so I watched the first season of the show, and in the show, there's the god Vulcan, right? So for those of you who don't know, first of all, it's a phenomenal TV show, right? It's just great. It's disturbing at times and all this kind of thing, but the whole premise of it is that you have like these old gods, right? These ancient gods who have all found their ways to kind of the shores of America, right? And they're planning a resurgence. And then you've got the new gods that are there too as well. So you've got, you know, anyways, so that's kind of the basis. I don't want to go into the whole show, but in that show, it's the god Vulcan, right? The god of fire and volcanoes in that show. And, you know, in the America, right, in contemporary America, the god Vulcan runs a firearms manufacturing plant. They produce guns. And you've got this scene where some of the lead characters are kind of going into this town for the first time. And everyone in the town is just armed to the teeth. Like old women in wheelchairs are packing, you know, they got their rifles and semi-automatic weapons. They're all carrying the AR-15s. That was what was going through my mind. And then I was listening to Majority Report and Sam Cedar was kind of talking about Moloch on this. I'm like, well, there you go. You know, child sacrifice and the god of fire and death. You know, I mean, I don't know how else you'd want to put it. It was horrible.
This is the world we're going down. Like, they want everyone to be armed to the teeth with a gun. I did not see Trump's response. I read about it. Basically, like, you know, the town should have known this guy was should have been more vigilant and stuff like that. Didn't mention guns at all. And, you know, it's the type of thing where you read some of the things that happen, especially how some of the journalists respond on Twitter. Basically, like when they were working when Columbine happened, basically like the whole entire newsroom stopped to see what was happening with Columbine.
Right.
Now it's like, all right, business as usual. You know, we have to carry on with our day.
Yep. And, you know, we've got the NRA to thank for that. Right. We've got spineless politicians to thank for that. You know, and
I mean, like the thoughts and prayers line is bullshit.
Totally. I mean, just give me a break. We're so far beyond that.
How are the Democrats not being more forceful with that? Like, oh, well, I guess they said thoughts and prayers. We can't politicize this. Like, they said thoughts and prayers. Like, I mean, like, you know, one of the things, it's like the when you have a party that doesn't stand for anything versus the Republican Party, you know, the party that doesn't stand for anything is going to get you know, and that's where I seem like for not being forceful enough. You know, it's Democratic Party for not being forceful enough in these situations.
And buying into the fear.
And not
willing
to drop the hammer on these people.
Yeah, exactly. They've bought into the fear that the NRA is the god. Like, so, okay, I want to give you this one little quote from American Gods. This is from the episode called A Murder of Gods. And this is Vulcan. This is what he says, right? So Wednesday, he's the god of Odin. You know, he's Odin, like, comes forward. This is the scene. And Vulcan says, "Those who worship hold the volcano in the palm of their hand. It's filled with prayers in my name. The power of fire is firepower, not God, but godlike, and they believe." And that is exactly what we see. This is a freaking cult of the gun. This is a cult that needs to be squashed and wiped out. And at the head of that is a freaking, like, an evil center of the NRA, which is about testing out its political slogans right on the bodies of children. And this is really what it comes down to. This is freaking disgusting. It's time that this stops. And you know what? And I even say that, Sean, and I know it's not. And I know that this is what we have to do. And we're going to see the same freaking cycle again, because, you know, again, and look, all the power to the people that have been in the streets arguing about this stuff, man. I mean, there's amazing work that's going on this, and that organizing is only increasing now again. But man, our politicians, man, either you get on the right side of this, right, or join the freaking evil cult leaders, right, with Vulcan and Moloch, right, because that's where you belong.
Yeah, I mean, we decided as a country, I said this before and I'll say it again, that doing nothing after Sandy Hook, that's when we decided where our moral compass was going.
That's right. Yeah. You've said that before.
As a country. Exactly. Like, and, you know, you have some Democrats that are out there they're out there screaming and shouting their lungs out, but, you know, it has to be everyone.
Yep. And if you're not going to get on the right side,
we can't do this because it's not politically expedient. Or, you know, start like beating these people at their own game. You know, like start going after them and beating them at their own game when it comes to the rhetoric being used.
No, that's absolutely right. And look, you know, I'm going to talk about this a little bit later in the second segment when we're talking about Howard Bunce's visit to campus the need to, you know, stand up and all this kind of stuff. You know, we just have to stop this kind of these cycles of reporting on this stuff too as well, which is just about we need to figure out what was going on through the heads of this person and treat it that this is an isolated incident. Right. This is why I like so much about what Sam Cedar was saying and that kind of dripping sarcasm and satire about, you know, saying thank you to the CEOs of these pages. Because this is exactly it. The AR-15, right, is the M16, except it fires at a semi-automatic way. It is a weapon of war that is hawked to our everyday people. Right. And then it is romanticized and it's publicized. And the right wing uses the AR-15 as a sign of, again, Colleen Clemens would talk about this as toxic masculinity. And it's exactly what it is, of this kind of like worshiping at the altar of the false gods of Moloch and Vulcan. And they're going to shop that shit out. Right. And what is it designed to do? The AR-15 is designed to kill and slaughter and rip people apart. And we are right now saying that's okay because unregulated free market capitalism. Because yeah, I mean, NRA.
Yeah.
Fuck that.
I was going to say, I think a bill became law in Pennsylvania. Governor Wolf signed into law allowing AR-15s to be used for hunting. And, you know, you talk to some of the hunters out there and they think that's just a damn disgrace that an AR-15 is allowed to be used for hunting, because at that point, either it takes the sport out of hunting, you know, the one shot, unload your rifle, or, you know, the semi, you know, like the one shot in the chamber type thing. And, you know, it takes the skill out of it. And all it is just allows amateurs to go out into the woods and start shooting up and trying to carving apart these animals. But it's like, I mean, like that, what's the point? I mean, you're just putting that gun in the hands of more people.
But look, what it is, all it is, I mean, we just got to have to, yes, it's true. You're absolutely right. But all it is that you're putting, when people get the AR-15, when they start saying that, oh, well, I'm just going out to blah, 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 because no, you're doing it because you're trying to inhabit an ideology of hate, of violence, of death. You are a death cult member. When you actually think the AR-15 is something that you need, because I've grown up around hunters, right? And they don't have AR-15s. And when you say, do you need an AR-15? They look at you kind of side-eyed and be like, no. No.
And the round that uses a 20, one of the things that people talk about, oh, it's only a 22. Yeah, I shot a 22. You know, like, you know, I shot a 22 in the Boy Scouts. You know what a 22 is? A 22 has a really short jacket to it. You know, and this thing, yeah, it's a 22, but, you know, there's a lot more stopping power with this gun. And the bullets that's designed to shoot. You're not shooting a short little 22 caliber bullet, you know, coming from a 22 caliber rifle. No, you're shooting a gun. You're shooting a bullet that is specifically designed to disseminate people, like
to rip apart their insides.
Yeah.
And destroy them.
Like a 22, you get shot by a 22 caliber rifle. Odds are you're going to survive. You get shot with a 228 round coming from an AR-15, that's going to rip apart your arm, rip apart that body part, blow up your insides.
Right. And you're going to tell me, like, inside all the marketing rooms of these board of directors, of the people that are kind of, you know, that work for these gun manufacturers, the fact that I didn't know this, and this is my own ignorance, right? Because I don't spend my time going through guns and ammo magazines all the time looking for the kind of like the coolest picture of some guy getting off with his freaking assault rifle. Right. But what the thing is that, you know, I didn't realize this, but most of the major weapons manufacturers, weapon manufacturers, weapons of war, right, hawkers of death, what they all have their versions of the AR-15. Because why? Because they're recognizing it as a symbol. They are not marketing the AR-15 simply because it's a good for hunting. It's a symbol that they recognize gets people wet in the panties to go out.
It's like someone driving a rigged out truck.
Exactly.
you know, they're compensating for something else.
They have a big dream. They wake up, they change their camo underwear, and they go out to the store and buy their AR-15. Right? I mean, that's what it is. It's a freaking death cult. And until we start treating it as such, that needs to be purged from American culture. Right? Because you know what happens when they, after they fully exploit it here and they're already doing it, they shop it across the world. These people have to be stopped. I mean, it's just let's put an end to the death cult, man. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Speaking of death wishes or death desires, we've got our own versions of this, folks, in the public sector right now, as we're going to see that next week. We'll actually get a chance to talk about it before it actually happens. So the 23rd, we have another podcast, and the 24th, there's going to be protests around the country about the Janus case. This is the Janus versus AFSCME case, which will be argued before the United States Supreme Court on Monday, February 26th. And you know, there's these rallies that are happening across the country. They're being dubbed a Working People's Day of Action. You know, they're all the major public sector unions from AFT, NEA, SEIU, and AFSCME are all pushing to kind of get out and into the streets for this. There's one in Philadelphia. That's the one that I'm going to be at. And I'll be down there for Raging Chicken. I might be down there with my kids. So we'll see. I mean, you know, my kids they know very well kind of what a union is, and they know that I'm union, and they know that, that, you know, we need to stand with unions. And so there's going to be one in, there's going to be one in Philadelphia. There's going to be one in, Pittsburgh. There's going to be one in Boyertown, I believe. There's, and some, the Posse campuses across the country are looking at having rallies on the 26th to, across the state are looking to have rallies on the 26th as well on college campuses. But you know, this is, I've got a very, very sinking feeling about this for good reason, I think. As much as, you know, again, I'm going to be the last person in the world that's going to kind of think that we shouldn't be in the streets. I think that we should be in the streets. You know, this is in the hands of the Supreme Court. The election was lost in 2016. Donald Trump got to appoint a right-wing, ultra-right-wing justice to the court. And so if you talk to anybody in public sector unions, we have virtually no hope that this case is going to go the right way. So what does that mean? It means that, yes, you have all these protests out here, but the protests effectively have to be about doubling down on the organizing. They have to be doubling down about getting out in the streets. And they have to be a wake-up call to all members of public sector unions that, look, business unionism is dead. Circling the wagons and trying to just take care of your own and, like, you know, making sure that, you know, that you can just deliver on services, man, that is the losing game right now. Is that resources of unions need to go towards organizing right now, right? And I could tell you, you know, I talked to the president of the New Jersey, the president of the kind of the faculty union at New Jersey State Colleges, and I talked to him a while back. And one of the things that he was telling me is like, oh no, they saw this as soon as they saw the Janus case was in the pipeline. They started kind of saying, okay, we got to start hiring organizers. Right. And that's what they did. My union, ABSCUF, we lost our organizer and we don't have another one. And Janus is coming down. We're probably going anywhere between next week and June 30th is that we're going to find out what that Supreme Court is going to say. And so the big question for my union, for every public sector union, for teachers unions across the state, across the country, for that matter, is that what are you doing to organize, right? What is your leadership doing to organize, right? How are they out in front of this, right? I do not believe, and I have no evidence whatsoever to believe that we can count on the goodwill of anybody to make sure that that we're not going to be decimated in the public sector. So, you know, time to read up. I want to highly recommend, there is a really important piece, I think. It's called The Two Faces of Janus. This just came out in the latest issue of In These Times. It's not online yet, right? I'm a subscriber to In These Times, right? Because I believe if you want independent media, hint, hint, you need to put up for it, right? You need to subscribe. Raging Chicken Press, right? Patreon.com/RagingChicken, or Patreon.com/RC Press, right? Become a member. So anyways, it's subscribed in these times, The Two Faces of Janus. It's a fantastic piece by Mary Batari. And I just want to kind of give you a kind of a little insight into a little about this. And this is kind of why this is important. And so bear with me. I'm just going to read you a couple paragraphs of this so you can get a hint of this article. This is something I'm going to be circulating to our own members too as well. So this is about Janus versus American Federation of AFSCME. Okay. In the past decade, and I'm reading from the article, in the past decade, a small group of people working for deep-pocketed corporate interests, conservative think tanks, and right-wing foundations have bankrolled a series of lawsuits to end what they call forced unionization. They say they fight in the name of free speech and workers' rights and workplace freedom. In briefs before the court, they present their public face, carefully selected at appealing plaintiffs like Illinois child support worker Mark Janus and California school teacher Rebecca Friedrichs. If you remember, Friedrichs' case is the one that ended up in a tie in the Supreme Court because Scalia died. That's the only reason that this hasn't happened sooner. The language that they use is relentlessly pro-worker. Behind closed doors, a different face is revealed. Those same people cheer defunding and bankrupting unions to deal a, quote, mortal blow to progressive politics in America. The key director of this charade is the State Policy Network, whose game plan is revealed in a union-busting toolkit uncovered by the Center for Media and Democracy. The first rule of the national network of right-wing think tanks that are pushing to dismantle unions, quote, rule number one, be pro-worker, not anti-union. Don't rant against unions, using phrases like union fat cats and corrupt union bosses and other negative languages reduces support for reform, unquote. And yet, the State Policy Network groups have systematically spearheaded attacks on unions and workers in state houses and courtrooms nationwide. The Janus case and its precursor, Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association, represents the State Policy Network's most audacious move yet, an effort to kneecap the unions of public sector workers, including teachers, nurses, sanitation workers, park rangers, prison guards, police, and firefighters in a single blow. And this is the last piece I'll read. The big thing you'll see right here is that there's these signs, right, that show up at these rallies being kind of, you know, astroturfly funded by the State Policy Network and so on. They hold signs at these rallies, right? There was a rally recently around the Supreme Court. They hold signs at these rallies with signs with little red apples that read, trust teachers and respect teachers. Do you respect teachers? Then respect their First Amendment rights. And from a distance, it looks like a teacher's rally. A closer look reveals an odd array of participants. Grover Norquist, the man who wanted to drown government in a bathtub, cheerfully declines an interview as he breezes by. Daniel Turner, who worked for the Education Reform Task Force of the far-right American Legislative Exchange Council, waves a trust teachers sign from behind the podium. Near him stands Chantel Lovell of State Policy Network's Mackinac Center of Public Policy, a group credited with jamming a union-busting bill through Michigan's lame duck legislature in 2012. And a representative from the State Policy Network's Arizona-based Goldwater Institute is present and is a fellow from the Koch brothers' Americans for Prosperity, who also declined an interview. Okay? So everything that Sean and I have been talking about on this show, have been talking about in the pages of a Raging Chicken Press, is about to happen. Is about to steamroll things. And so I guess we all have the choice. What do we do about this?
And yeah, and here in Pennsylvania, we have, you know, two things that are going on. Scott Wagner's running for governor. And, you know, he's being supported by the State Policy Network think tank, you know, part of that Koch brother think tank, the Commonwealth Foundation. And, you know, the Commonwealth Foundation, Matt Briette, and the, you know, Wagner and Wagner's campaign staff are, you know, in cahoots with each other. Always see them together downtown in Harrisburg walking around together.
Yep, that's right.
I mean,
they're look, you know, I love the picture that you've got, right? You took that picture of those folks like hanging out, like out, you know, just right there on, you know, right out in
right
the view of the Capitol, huh?
Out right across the street from the Capitol.
Yep.
Standing on the corner outside of their campaign office, which is in that big building right across the street from the Capitol.
Yep.
The Commonwealth Foundation. Everyone knows where Scott Wagner's campaign office is at.
Exactly. So if you have any questions about this, I mean, so, you know, we've been talking about how important the 2018 election is, right, in the state of Pennsylvania. I mean, we're going to get into the gerrymandering stuff and all the stuff coming up. But you got to understand, folks, is that, you know, for progressives who only pay attention to national politics, man, wake the frick up. right, is like right now that national politics, where everyone's been following as some sort of freaking removed drama that you can watch on TV, is happening right here in our state. Right. And it's all poised. Pennsylvania is like it like ground zero in this fight in so many ways. Right. And that state policy network, those Koch brothers stuff, the American Legislative Exchange Council, right, have fully infiltrated, right, the Republican Party of this state. And they're already positioning people like Scott Wagner. Right. Wagner's their buddy candidate so that they can complete their agenda. So this is it, man. This is it. Last thing I'll just have to say before we take a little bit of a break, we get into some of the state stuff, because the state stuff is important this week. I don't want to spend too much time on the national thing. But we do have one hope. We have one potential knight in shining armor, Sean, that could help us reclaim our country, and that is Mitt Romney.
Is it going to be Bud Knight?
Mitt Romney running for the Utah Senate.
Yeah, you know, like the person that told like 40% of the country to fuck off.
Yeah, basically,
is now looking like the voice of reason in this fucking party. Let's. I've been thinking about this like all week. Like, not only failed 2-time presidential candidate, blah blah blah. The person that told 47% of the country to pretty much fuck off in the 2012 election is now seen as like the bastion of resistance against Donald Trump.
Yep.
Let that sink in.
Well, I was just gonna say, I want to get you a T-shirt, Sean, and that all it says on the front is "Let that sink in." Because how many times have you been saying this? Like now about this? Like just wait. Let's take a step back here and just let's think about this. Let's just let this sink in and marinate for a bit.
Yeah, I mean, this is like people who think Charlie Dent is a moderate.
Oh my God, I know.
Like when or I mean, like it's. Yeah.
And what we should be clear about this, right? So they're like, okay, I'll tell you, when I moved to Allentown in 2002, right, when I first moved to Pennsylvania, I moved to Allentown. And of course, Charlie Dent's a representative there, right? And so Charlie Dent at that time.
I mean, he's a nice guy personally. No, I've met him a couple times.
I'm not, this has nothing to do with him personally, right? Charlie Dent, right, was considered conservative, a right wing conservative. Right. When I would talk to people in the area, things like this. Right. Oh, my God. He's on the right. Like he's dangerous because he's smart and he's like, you know, he's not a crazy, but he's like he's on the right. And so that was 2002. Right. And then 2018. Right. I recognize it's 16 years, but like historically, that's not a huge amount of time. Now he's considered like the far left of the Republican Party. Right. To the point where he's being forced out. Let's be clear about this. Charlie Dent has not moved his positions. Right.
Yeah.
The party has moved. So the party has moved so far to the right that Charlie Dent is barely in the Republican Party anymore. That's what we have to understand. These are not the Republicans that, like, you know, your parents grew up with or you remember as a kid. No, these are extremists. Right.
Yeah.
Death cult wishing, worshiping extremists is what they are. Anyways. All right. When we come back, we're going to get into the gerrymandering stuff. This is really big news in Pennsylvania. Lots of stuff is happening, unfolding today about what's going to be the future of this of the gerrymandering case. But we're going to get right back to all that. And I'm going to remind you, folks. We need you to step up. We need you to step up and keep the movement in the media and the media in the movement by supporting Raging Chicken Press. I need you to go to patreon.com/RC Press and become a member today. Become a member as little as $5 a month. If you come in at the $10 a month level, we will send you Steven Singer's book, Gadfly on the Wall. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be right back with Sean Kitchen, and we're going to get into it once again. See ya.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2011. That was the day Madison public school teachers held a sick out in opposition to Governor Scott Walker's anti-labor assaults. Walker had introduced Assembly Bill 11, later known as Act 10. This union-busting bill proposed the elimination of collective bargaining rights for public sector workers regarding health and pension benefits, limited wage increases, eliminated dues collection, and mandated annual union recertification. immediately, tens of thousands of protesters descended on the state capitol, chanting "Kill the Bill," and took part in hearings to voice their opposition. Area schools remained closed for days as protests continued to grow throughout the spring. While parts of Act 10 have been ruled unconstitutional in the years since, the legislation has nonetheless wreaked havoc. A series in Milwaukee's Journal Sentinel titled Act 10 at 5 examined how public school teachers have fared since the Madison uprising. They found that 75% of school districts are losing teachers, retirements have surged, less are entering the profession, and most job hop to the highest salary offers. The teachers' unions report major losses. MTEA notes that membership is down 30%. WEAC reports that membership and dues collection were cut in half. Seniority rights have evaporated and layoffs are increasingly tied to performance. Annual salary growth has slowed, stopped, or reversed. Teacher morale is low in many districts. Teachers often complain of additional unpaid duties, larger class sizes, and more performance reviews. There are new restrictions on attire, as well as speech and political activities. If there is any good news, it is that unions survive annual recertification and remaining members are more active and more engaged in union work.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. Now, Sean has put in an official request to start with something that to lighten the mood up a little bit before we get into the gerrymandering case. So, what better way to lighten up the mood than talk about pot?
Whoa, I don't know what you're talking about there. So this week, first medical marijuana dispensaries have opened up in Pennsylvania. Now, everything is edibles and oils. There are nothing you can smoke, unfortunately, you know, which would be a lot better if people can do that. But there are a couple of dispensaries open up. I think one opened up in our area the other day. It's called Organic Remedies. And it's right down the street from Pizza Boy.
Yeah, well, that's convenient.
It's a beer pod happy.
Yeah, there you go. There's another one like literally in Sellersville, which is the town next town over from me. It's called Terra Vita Holistic Center in Sellersville, and Keystone Shops in Devon. Right, so we're kind of in the area that they're actually setting up. And I have to say, I was actually very pleased to see these dispensaries setting up outside of major metropolitan areas, because originally I know there was some concern. Where they were looking at the kind of applications, some of the original rounds of applications for the dispensaries, they were kind of concentrated around these major metropolitan areas, when arguably it's kind of more important to have them in kind of, say, rural areas or underserved areas or poor areas. And precisely because is that, you know, especially when you're talking about pain medication, you're talking about cancer treatment, you're talking about, and all sorts of kids who have, you know, epileptic fits and all this kind of stuff, like as babies, a whole bunch of range of things that people that need access to them, and you have to bring these things to where people need them. And, you know, especially you're talking about areas that, you know, could dramatically reduce the cost of some of their medical treatments by using medical marijuana as opposed to some of these, you know, Merck-inspired drugs.
Yeah. And I mean, states have had, medical marijuana legalized or marijuana outright legalized have seen rates of marijuana use within teenagers drop, because you have to actually go to a store and buy it. You know, if you're under 21, you won't be able to get it in states like Colorado, California, and stuff like that. And they also have seen opioid overdoses drop. And you know, it's about time we're starting to change up our drug policy here locally in Philadelphia. Krasner has dropped all simple marijuana possession cases. He's told people not to bring any cases forward, you know, not even to waste his time with that. And then also one of the things that we've seen open up, which is a lot more controversial in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia, has a lot of state officials really angry about this, especially Attorney General Josh Shapiro. But Krasner and Mayor Kenney are working on getting heroin addiction centers opened up, to where people who are heroin addicts can go inside these centers, safely take their drugs, and, you know, so they don't overdose on the street or something like that, where they have. And, you know, for some people, it's you're kind of feeding that beast, but it's also the type of thing you're dealing with this epidemic in a responsible way, allowing people to have safe access to needles, who, and also try to get them in treatment too. You know, make them feel like a human being and not make them feel like they're criminals.
Right.
Which, you know, in some countries that have done this already, these addiction centers actually work in reducing the number of heroin overdose deaths and actual people who are addicted to the program, because it's a way to get them into treatment.
Well, there you have it. I mean, that's a, you know, this has been a long, hard fought fight, you know, and, you know, I have to say is, like, I remember, you know, when you were covering this in some of the early days, right, in the state capitol, when you had these women coming out with their kids, right, that were kind of out in front of this fight in the, you know, in the rotunda, who had been pushing for this for a long time. That, you know, huge kudos to all them, to the activists who kind of helped make this happen.
Yeah. And I also think the person who leading the fight against this is resigning, Matthew Baker. Just a part of the Republicans that are deciding not to run in.
Does he have a son that he wants to take his place?
He does not. He does not. But
because from what I understand, if he did, he could probably run on the Democratic ticket, right?
So this is something that I see as bad government.
Yeah.
Okay. And both sides are guilty of this. So Pennsylvania representatives, House leadership, Mark Kosik and Hanna. Representative Hanna is the House Minority Whip, and Representative Mark Kosik is the Appropriations Chair for the Democratic Party, which is pretty much one of the most powerful positions you can have in a minority party, is being the head of the Appropriations Chair. It's one of the most powerful positions you can have, period. They are both resigning, and they said they'd like to see their kids, who are 35 and 25, to take over their seats.
House of Lords, man. House of Lords.
Which is something that Senator Greenleaf is in the same predicament. He's trying to get, you know, there's rumblings that his son, Stuart Greenleaf Jr., is going to be running for office. I mean, there's people in Center County who still think they're voting for Jake Corman Sr.
Right.
At this point, when it's Jake Corman Jr. who's in office. I mean, this is the type of thing. It's done on both sides of the aisle. It's utterly ridiculous. It's bad government at its worst, and it's, you know, you're giving someone a seat who pretty much, as a 25-year-old,
is probably going to keep it
never
for
have
the rest
to work
of their lives.
Again a day in their life, pretty much.
Yep.
They're exactly in there for 10 or 15 years. They get a pension for life, and then they're set.
Right, and it'll be the only life that they knew, right, is being a politician, right? Because they were the kid of a politician, and now they're going to be a politician themselves, and that dramatically limits their experience. I'm not saying that, you know, that we should exclude kind of family members from running, but I do think it's a problem. Like, I used the example when we were talking earlier about this, you know, you look at Fitzpatrick, right? You had Mike Fitzpatrick, Brian Fitzpatrick, right? So one resigns and the brother takes over. They use the same logo, the same signage and everything else like that, you know, and most people don't pay attention to so much attention to, you know, these kind of elections.
Which Fitzpatrick they're voting for.
Right. So they're just like, oh, Fitzpatrick, still Fitzpatrick running. Sure. He seems like a nice guy. Boom. And they vote for this dude. Right. And that has nothing to say about, you know, is this person qualified? That's not the point. But the point is that this is toxic to a democracy.
And also, I mean, I think that, like, Casey, who's turning out to be he's a good senator, Casey. I mean, he can be pushed. He's bad on the pro-life issues, abortion issues.
Yeah, I'm gonna leave you with a quote of saying Casey is a good senator. I'm not going there with you. I mean, I think he's done some good things, but.
He's been a lot more active and vocal in the past year and a half since Trump's gotten elected than, you know, he was Pennsylvania's third most famous groundhog.
Exactly. He woke up, apparently, and he decided to stay out of his den.
He's been running around getting all that sunshine. But, I mean, like, Casey at least waited 20 years till his father was out of office as governor to become the United States Senator of Pennsylvania. I mean, he had a career before that. It wasn't like, boom, it was just – I mean, yeah, it was pretty much handed to him. They cleared the field for him. But, I mean, yeah, I don't know.
But I think the point is this, right? The big point is this. And I think that –
Like, you have your political families.
Right. And you have – this goes on, and we know this stuff goes on. But also, I mean, it kind of connects up why it matters to me that this is happening in the Democratic Party right now in the state, right? It just goes to speak to other issues that we've been pointing to over and over again. is that the Pennsylvania State Democratic Party has failed to develop a kind of like a training and leadership and cultivate people from the grassroots. Just like we heard at the Keystone Progress Summit, right? You've got, you know, you got candidates that want to run. They've got grassroots support. And the first what they get from the PA Democratic Party and the National Democratic Party is like, you know, show me your phone and your contact list and show me how you're going to get money. Right. And that's what they come up with instead of actually cultivating and working in the communities and developing that leadership. Right. I have no problem if somebody wants to run somebody's kid and want to run that. But you know what? Maybe there should be a primary. Right. Maybe that person shouldn't be anointed. Maybe they should actually have to go through an election and see if they're actually qualified to do it.
Yeah. I mean, like with Shalief Street, I mean, he's been a pretty good he's been doing the right things, going through the motions and everything. He's the son of Milton Street, you know, in Philadelphia, who ran for office. But I mean, I mean, there's politics for everything that happens in there. But yeah, I mean, you have people who are political families that, you know, run for office. But it's not like, all right, so-and-so resigned, so I want my kid in there next.
Yep.
Which is, yeah.
Yeah, it's messed up. It's messed up.
And also, Hannah, if we really want to start picking at straws here, Representative Hannah was the one who tried to ban municipalities from banning plastic bags in within those districts, because one of Hannah's top campaign donors was a plastic bag manufacturer inside his district.
Mm-hmm. And if you ever want to know, hey, do you ever know what some of the key kind of ingredients for plastic bags are, Sean?
I think oil.
Yeah,
petroleum,
and I think ethylene and things like this. That, you know, there's that cracker plant. So we're fracking the hell out of our state to go to the cracker plant to make plastic freaking bags.
Yeah,
just saying. Yeah. Connect the dots, everybody. That's shout out to Dory for that one. Connect the dots. So, anyways, yeah, seriously. So, all right, let's talk a little bit about the gerrymandering stuff, because this is actually, I mean, this is making national news, right? And this has potential far-reaching implications for both us in the state, but also for national politics. So, walk us through a little bit about just kind of like what's happened over the past week to get us and where we are today.
So last week, you know, we pretty much talked about what the Republicans were going to do, which was, you know, hand Governor Wolf a map that he will reject, which they did check, and that they handed him a really bad map so the fact that he can reject it. Now, their strategy, their game plan is to bring a federal – they're going to be bringing a federal lawsuit forward when the new maps are picked by the Supreme Court, basically saying that the Supreme Court does not have the authority to draw the maps. This is their game plan that's going on here. And they're using the moniker that, you know, having the Supreme Court redraw the maps, since they don't have the jurisdictional or they don't have the judicial precedent to do so. They're not, as in, they don't have the authority to do so. They're calling this a constitutional crisis within the state.
You know, it's been remarkable to me to see how ready the media has been to pick that up, right? Especially kind of like if you look at headlines from national media, things like this whole idea of a constitutional crisis has just been picked up like, oh, this is a cool way to frame what's happening in Pennsylvania.
And it, I mean, like these are even, and this is again them winning the framing message, because you have Senator Scarnati, Senator Cormann, and Representative Terzai who have refused to comply by the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. And handing over their data to them before when they were drawing up the maps. And then they turn around and say this is a constitutional crisis because the Supreme Court does not have the authority to draw the maps. And what they're doing is they're just running out the clock on this, you know, basically trying to do everything they can to make sure the original gerrymandered maps stay in place for the 2018 election.
Right.
And also another thing is that no one is stopping anyone from bringing a lawsuit forward. I'm challenging the districts, the House and Senate districts, because since this went through the state courts and up to the state Supreme Court, people will be able to bring a map forward, or they'll be able to challenge these challenge the gerrymandered House and Senate districts under the same arguments and potentially have these maps thrown out by the 2020 election.
Yeah. So where are we at right now? I mean, so I guess last night was the deadline, right? And
yes, so Governor Wolf, the House, Senate Democrats, and a couple of Republican activists have all handed their maps over to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, I guess, is going to decide now which map to pick, and they're going to run with it. The map that the Republicans brought forward might have changed up the shapes a little bit, made the map a little bit sexier, But it still kept the partisan scores the same pretty much. And I mean, like the GOP advantages did not shift at all.
No, as the Washington Post was reporting there, it says, like, you know, this is from the article that they're writing about this, is saying from the partisan standpoint, basically the plan that the Republicans submitted last week is nearly identical. And so, yes, the shapes don't look so funky, but it would still have created 12 Trump districts and 6 Clinton ones, right? Virtually identical to where we stand right now.
Yeah. And it moved Houlihan out of Costello's district, who is the primary challenger to Costello. And it would move Connor Lamb out of the 18th district, who is the primary challenger to Rick Saccone.
Right. Right. What I found that was kind of interesting about this, too, is there was just to put in perspective what the Republican plan looked like. So Wolf basically hired this this woman, Moon Duchin, I think is how you say her, or Duchin, or Duchin, I think is how you say her name. She's from Tufts University, and basically she's this is kind of what she does. And she ran a bunch of computer modeling programs that basically saying, okay, let's look at all these different kinds of scenarios just to kind of see what will come up to fairness of. You take partisanship out of the issue, and you run basically, you know, you basically use the criteria that's laid out in the state constitution and that kind of stuff. So how do you develop these districts? And, you know, kind of generated hundreds of different models and found that there was only a 0.1% chance that a plan that was drawn using these things to the court's order would have been favorable to the Republicans as the proposed map, or as favorable to the Republicans as a proposed map from the GOP. So basically saying, okay, look, the state Supreme Court said, here's your criteria, and the chances of that having, you know, you'd have to work really hard in order to kind of produce a map in the way that they did. And that was kind of her point. Now, having said that, we should also say that even like the House Democratic Caucus plan, or the Democratic plan came up, is not something that is now just the polar opposite, right? It's not one that shows, oh, now the Democrats have a majority in the state. We're still not talking about that.
No. And because of the geography, it's extremely hard for Democrats to even have a 9-9 gerrymandered map. Right. The maps they put out would produce a 7-11 state map, pretty much, you know, 7 Democrats to 11 Republicans. But the thing is, the point of the matter is that what they did with the 2011 map was obviously gerrymandered.
Right.
You know,
right.
You really can't defend that map. And one of the arguments that House Republican spokesperson Stephen Miskin has been putting out was that Democrats are self-packing, sort of like self-deporting themselves into blue districts, right, across the state. But here's the thing. You have Pittsburgh and Philadelphia are the two big liberal, Democratic epicenters of the state. But the way that they drew the maps in the suburbs of Philadelphia, right, you know, having them pretty much every Republican possible, making these districts very GOP heavy. And then also the way that they split up the Lehigh Valley, the Reading area, Allentown was all packed into a district that ran all the way out to the outskirts of Harrisburg.
No, yeah, you look at that dense district, right? It runs from Easton and just follows 222
corridor.
No, it's 222. You look at 222 for a good chunk of 222. It runs all the way there, and then it breaks off and then heads out to Harrisburg. Right. I mean, it follows the road, basically.
Yeah, it follows. It pretty much follows I-78 going out to Harrisburg. Right. And then you have Erie, which is split in half. Right. Which, you know, and then you have Reading, which is split three ways.
Right.
You know, these are areas that should have, and Harrisburg is also split in half. You know, the Midtown neighborhood of Harrisburg and Susquehanna Township is in Scott Perry's district. The rest is in Lou Barletta's district. You know, so you have these districts that are 100 miles long, 2 hours to get through one end to the other, or 100 miles wide, like going out from Allentown to Harrisburg along that 78 corridor. I mean, these are things that, yes, like these are areas that Democrats can pick up by just having regularly drawn districts.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, like, and I think the point is that maps, if you're talking about like, you know, what the point of these things are supposed to be in kind of a democracy is that actually the representatives from those particular areas are supposed to represent those areas. And what you've basically ensured through the Republican maps from before and now is you've basically ensured that those communities, right, like that are, say, urban districts like, you know, not Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, but well, even to that some degree, but like Reading, like Harrisburg, like Allentown, like Bethlehem, like Easton, they're not going to be represented by by their people, because the majorities are coming from outside of their areas. And that's kind of the whole idea, is that you want to have representatives that are representing kind of the people of their district.
Yeah, exactly. And also some of the things that you have is, you know, in a one of the House Democrats maps, I think, or the Senate Democrats, it pretty much puts Allentown, Reading, and Bethlehem in the same district.
Yep.
Which is
what, I mean, the whole thing is branded, right? Even the airport is ABE, Allentown, Bethlehem, Easton, right?
Yeah, it pretty much groups everything into that same census area or that metropolitan area.
Right, exactly.
I mean, like, you have these, you know, districts drawn around the metropolitan areas rather than, you know, half of Harrisburg is, you know, going all the way up through Hazleton, Pennsylvania.
Indeed. So I guess, you know, do we have any sense of when we're going to hear about this?
I do not know. But the game plan for the Republicans is to bring the next map to federal court right away and try to prolong this fight as long as possible so they can keep the 2010 maps in place for the upcoming election.
Well, here we go. So I guess we're going to see this pretty soon. And I know there's a lot of people that are sitting on pins and needles to speak about this too. I mean, we've got some races like, you know, the 7th, for example, that we've got a whole range of candidates on the Democratic side of the ticket that are kind of preparing to you know, run in primaries. You've got all sorts of new candidates that are emerging across the state that have been active since Trump got elected, have kind of joined in the fight and are going to be running for office. And so I know that we were at the Keystone Progress Summit a couple of weeks back that I talked to a bunch of those folks who, you know, they're kind of like, you know, not nervous as much as kind of a little anxious and wanted to find out, okay, you know, how do they campaign? Are they going to be able to stay in the same district or not?
Yeah. I know a couple of the maps have Costello and Smucker facing against each other in a primary. Mm-hmm. And then another map has Rothis and someone else facing off in a primary. So there's going to be the maps are going to produce a couple Republicans running against each other in a primary.
Mm-hmm.
Because of how the lines are getting redrawn.
Right. No, well, we'll see. I mean, that's kind of on the way. I mean, it was kind of good to see that, at least I have to say, I give the kudos to Governor Wolf on this for basically saying no to an obvious attempt to, you know, continue to pack the legislature by the Republicans. I'm also, you know, I'm encouraged that the way forward, it looks like, okay, the Democrats didn't simply just try to produce the complete polar opposite map, which would have looked insane too as well. But there is at least an attempt to get us back to the realm of sanity. So hopefully the next step will be talking about, you know, kind of having an independent commission or something like this, where we're not going to have to go through this every census period. So we'll see. So crazy. So, you know, I think this is all the more important now too, as well, since, you know, we've got, you know, crazy is still running rampant with Scarnati basically calling for kind of impeachment and the
Republic. Well, he said he has not ruled out impeachment.
Well, you know, whatever. Ruled out impeachment is supposedly a threat that he's planning on one of the impeachment.
But they're looking at ethics complaints and a lawsuit.
Right. So whatever, you know, I mean, this guy, like, this is, in my mind, this is part of the crazy. But you take that and you put it next to the fact that the PA Republicans have just basically gone all in with the alt-right right now. I mean, there you go. I mean, I don't think how clear this could be about why it's important this gerrymandering stuff goes through.
Yeah. I'm glad we brought that up. I forgot about that. Yeah. Scott Wagner and Lou Barletta gets the endorsements of the Republican Party this week, basically, you know.
Exactly.
Scott Wagner, who called George Soros a Hungarian Jew who hates America, who has Steve Bannon working with him, who has a Roy Moore supporter giving him $50,000, and who gave $1,000 to Lyndon LaRouche, gets the endorsement of the Republicans.
There it is.
And then Lou Barletta gets, you know, who pals around with, you know, racist. Plain and
how would you call it? I mean, let's call it what it is. Racist, spade, right? Spade. White supremacists.
So I want to know, did they take their hoods off for the vote?
Yeah, that's a big question, right? I think they wanted to keep the secret ballot, so I think they left them on.
Yeah, they left. It was bring your bed sheets to to the to.
Look, this is the exact thing that we've talked about this so often. It just drives me nuts. Is that the thing is that look, if you reject white supremacy as a party, right? You cannot endorse Lou Barletta. You cannot get behind officially with Scott Wagner. I mean, just period. And so and they'll tell you things like, well, you don't understand.
Scott Wagner basically called minimum wage workers a bunch of lazy black people who are on their cell phones at McDonald's all the time.
Exactly. We've played the audio on this like 1,000 times. I mean, it's like, you know, these are the people. Right. And so, look, if you as a party reject that stuff, guess what you got to do? Not endorse these people.
So I was looking. So here you go. Have you ever heard of Virginia Dare?
No.
OK, so Virginia Dare in folklore, American folklore, was the first white baby ever born in the American colonies. Right.
OK.
She was born in Johnstown or Jamestown, in Virginia.
Yeah.
Jamestown, the lost colony. So. There's a blog out there called vdare.com, which is named after the first white baby ever born on this continent.
Okay.
And
anchor baby, you mean, right?
Yeah. Surprise, surprise. It's a very extremist blog ran by someone named Peter Brimelow and a bunch of other people associated with Richard Spencer. They're always going to the H.L. Mencken Club. And like, these are a couple of the people that Barletta has sat down with. He sat down with someone who runs a blog named after the first white baby born in the United States, like United States colony. Like you pretty much know what you're getting here.
Yep. There you go, man. There you go. So congratulations, PAGOP. At least you've made your intentions clear. And now everybody in this state knows who you are. Right. And makes it very difficult for your everyday Republicans, right, to look at their party and say, no, they're not racist. Well, here you go. Your party just endorsed it.
And we're at war with illegal immigrants.
Right. Exactly. So there you go.
2 days ago. So
absolutely insane.
He's sending that stuff out in mailers comparing Casey to Schumer.
Oh, God. My God. My God. My God. Yep. That's where we live, folks. So I guess one thing I want to kind of touch upon. So we've been following this here, and I've been writing about this over at Raging Chicken. Yesterday at Kutztown University, Howard Bunces, if you recall, if you've been reading anything at Raging Chicken, listening to this podcast, you know that Howard Bunces, he's a professor from Eastern Michigan University. He's an accounting professor, and part of what he does, as you know, part of his living is basically doing an analysis of the financial conditions of colleges, universities, particularly in the public sector. Okay. And basically, he does it in such a way as to try to arm faculty members and staff members and students with the information to combat the bullshit that the universities, the college universities administrations give them about their quote unquote budgets. Right. And one of the first things that and you can read this in Raging Chicken. We have a link in the show notes to my interview with Howard Bunces that I did on Tuesday, which basically when he stopped literally, within the first like 30 seconds of talking to him, he stopped me and corrected me. He said, I do not analyze budgets. When I said the word budgets, he said budgets are fictions. They're constructed. They're wish lists from administrations. Right. And so he was on campus basically walking everybody through this budget. I got to say, it's like he says in the interview that we published on Raging Chicken Press, he kind of doubled down on that stuff. And he basically showed, no, this is exactly the problem. The problem is that faculty and staff members believe their administrations. Right. The administrations basically show these budgets, right, how the sky is falling, just like Kutztown University President Kenneth Hawkinson did last week, like sent out the sky is falling budget in response to the Bunces report, and basically was like, Oh, no, we're $6 million in the hole and blah, blah, blah. And the faculty members themselves, right? Other faculty members, staff members look at that and say, oh, my God, I guess we are really in dire straits. And then when we start talking about this from, say, the union perspective or the reporting that we give from Raging Chicken Press, and even with this outside, you know, independent, like, analysis from Howard Bunce's, like, people are like, well, I don't know. Do they have all their facts right? Do they really know what's going on? It's remarkable to see. It's remarkable to see that this, you know, and Bunce has said this to me too in the interview. He basically said, you know, what I see on not just Kutztown University's campus, but the Pashi system as a whole, is that faculty members, number one, they still tend to believe their administrations, despite the fact that their everyday working conditions and what they see in their their working lives contradicts what the university has says. They'll still end up kind of like, at least believing the administration or being skeptical enough about the union's position that they won't act. And then there was a climate, and this is what he said, a climate of fear, right? And a climate of apathy, right? And that's a real problem. You know, and we talked about the Janus decision coming down at the first part, you know, during the first part of our show today. But that's really kind of what concerns me, is because if you're afraid, right? And I asked him this directly. I said, well, what do you say to that faculty member that basically says, okay, look, I'm afraid because they're talking about a budget axe and it's going to come down. So the best thing I can do, just keep my head down and move on. Right? And he's basically said, well, okay, you can do that. That's the path of least resistance. But, you know, good luck to you. Because he said, based upon his analysis and his experience, they're looking at a cut. He thinks that Pashi is positioning itself right now from a cut of 1/5 to 1/3 of the faculty members. Right. Primarily by getting rid of, by allowing attrition on the one hand, not replacing positions and no more tenure. Right. And maximizing the use of adjunct faculty. That's it. Right. And so here you've got the numbers. And, you know, basically what he says is like, look, when they produce a budget, what you have to understand, all a budget is, it's a wish list from administrators. Right. He said what he does is he examines the audited financial reports. Like, so in other words, the way he put it, instead of like, you know, what they want to be or hope to be the budget versus what actually happened, the audited financial reports. And Bunce's examines the audited financial reports. Right. And in those audited financial reports, they show you that the administration has been lying to faculty, lying to staff and lying to students. Right. So one of the key things that we saw this past week is when Kenneth Hawkinson, the president of Kutztown University, released his kind of like sky is falling kind of budget projections, like the world is coming to an end, stuff like that. We've cut to the bone and still we're not out of trouble on hot water. In that report, what do you see as one of the main initiatives? There's some more of the same. Everything's in very general language and blah, blah, blah. We need savings and all that stuff. Savings usually means cut of more faculty members. We need flexibility. That means adjunct faculty instead of tenure track faculty. And we need to introduce a student success fee, right? A student success fee. In other words, we are going to charge students more money as opposed to giving up our pet projects. We are going to saddle students with more debt as opposed to giving up what our little budget projections want to be. Right. And I've been looking at a way of trying, you know, part of the difficulty here is how do you explain this stuff to people that doesn't make their eyes glaze over? Right. Because when you start talking about financial reports and budgets and all this kind of stuff, I mean, it's hard work for me to pay attention to this stuff. Right. And I'm a highly motivated actor here. Right. But when you're actually trying to communicate this stuff, and, you know, the example I kept on using when I was talking to people about this, I said, look, a budget is like this. If I'm sitting there and I'm the president of a university and I've got my little kind of, you know, my little group of acolytes around me, and I'm sitting there thinking about, you know, what do I want the university to be? It's like, you know, I remember when I was in college, what I thought would be so cool is if we had a gathering place on campus, like, you know, some fountains and some nice outdoor spaces that's really nicely manicured. And we have some tables out there and we have an outdoor coffee shop, you know, because I was down there in Union Square in New York and they've got this like, you know, they have this outdoor restaurant with tables. It's like something like that. You know, we could kind of like bring Union Square in New York City and could transport it to our campus because it would be a great selling point for the university. Very attractive. And we could use it for PR and all our ad campaigns to try to attract more students. Forget about retaining those students, but attracting those students there. And when I need a little break, I can go out for a walk across campus and sit down and have a coffee outdoor by the fountains, right? So I want to do that, right? And look, there is nothing to say that you couldn't do that, right? Say, for example, you wanted to, quote unquote, beautify your campus, right? And then this is a pet project that you want. So you budget for it. You say that, okay, in order to get that, we're not going to go out and take a bunch of loans. We're just going to start socking a few $100,000 a year into this special account, right? And we'll call it, you know, we don't want to call it the outdoor cafe account, right? Because that makes it sound like we don't need it. So we're going to call it the special project fund, right? So the special project fund is going to get $300,000, whatever, $200,000. You pick a number every single year, right? And the way they account for that on their little ledgers, right? The administration of finance people go off and do, you know, they do their magic. And on their spreadsheets, that shows that this is a cost, right? And to most people, if you were to examine that quote unquote budget, you're looking at their books, you would look at that and you would say, oh my God, they just, you know, look, they spent $300,000 over here, right? So they think that money is gone. But in reality, it's not gone. It's in the bank for that fund. Okay? So they do that. Now what happens is that you have a state, the state appropriations comes by, right? And they say, well, first we're going to cut the university like Corbett did back in 2011. We're going to cut the university by 20%, right? And maybe there's some other issues that are going on. Tuition revenue doesn't keep up. Maybe there's a little bit of a drop off in this here, whatever it might be. But the revenues are coming in. And the thing is, they look at it, they're like, man, you know, it looks like it's going to be really tough for us to keep putting that $200,000 or $300,000 away to get our little coffee shop, outdoor coffee shop, right? So, but I really want it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to keep putting that money there, and I'm going to put – this year I'm going to put $500,000 in that account, right? And then it's going to seem like a cost, and then I'm going to go and tell my faculty and tell the staff and tell the students, look, we're $500,000 in the hole. We missed our budget projections. We got a deficit, right? When in reality, the money is there. It's just been allocated for something else by their choice. And so that student success fee is so important when we're looking at kind of what Hawkinson at Kutztown University has been suggesting, because this is happening all over the state. This is not just Kutztown. This is happening all over the state. What is going on is that they're saying to students, look, instead of us giving up on our pet projects and on what we decided in our little kind of like small group backroom decision-making process, instead of giving up on our wish list, which helps them get more money, which helps them build their resume so they can get higher positions, which helps them keep them well-paid and higher paid and hiring more managers, right? Instead of doing that, we're gonna take more money from you, students. We're going to call it a student success fee, because who disagrees with student success, right? So we've got these initiatives, right? And they're going to cost something. So we're just going to take some money from you and we're going to kind of put it aside to our pet projects. That's what's going on. And that's the best kind of thing I could come up with to try to get people to understand what is actually happening. That's the difference between the budget and the financial report. The financial report is actually, this is what they did. They put this amount of money in a bank account for this pet project down the road. Their budget is like, well, we project that we have these costs, right? They don't tell you that their costs are for things that they don't need. And they don't tell you that they're taking it out of the hides of faculty members, classroom instruction, right? Laying it on student debt, I should put it that way. So when Bunce's report yesterday, he shows that, look, the administration, they go out and they tell the public and they tell Pashi and they tell legislators that faculty are like 50% of the cost of the university. Man, we're a freaking drain, man. 50% of the cost of the university. In some cases, it's a little higher than that. 53-55% of the university cost goes to faculty, right? Why is that so much of the cost of the university? Well, because of collective bargaining. Because faculty have benefits and they have this kind of stuff. When in actuality, that is what they budget. They say in their budgets that that's what the cost is. What Bunches' analysis revealed is, guess how much of the cost, the total university's expenditures, go to faculty? It's about one third, 33.3%, 33.2%, 33.5%, depending on the year. So in other words, in an institution of higher education, a third of the total cost of the university are going towards faculty. And that number is on the decline. the number of hires. One of the most striking things from me as someone who believes as in the mission of higher education, one of the striking numbers there was looking at the number of newly hired assistant professors, right? So that's like new hired, they're coming at the bottom of the scale, right? Assistant professor, tenure track assistant professors, right? And it was like watching something roll down a steep hill. So what they've done is that as people have retired, they've lowered the number of assistant professors that they've hired. As people have retired, they have not replaced those positions, and they've backfilled in the need with adjunct faculty members. That's what's going on. So students, on the back of students and their student success fee and the increasing amount of student loans, right? Pennsylvania being what? It's like any depending on which analysis you look, number one or number three in the country in student loan debt. And so that's being offloaded onto students' backs to fund pet projects at the expense of faculty and staff. Because also in the Bunces report, and I think I talked about this last week, but also in the Bunces report, we're saying the only group, right, that saw an increase in hiring during the same period from 2007 till 2018, right, was non-professional staff. In other words, people that are directly report to administrators, right? One of the highest costs are student support services, which Bunches says is code for administrators. Right? The money that the administrators are getting in raises is astounding. As they cut faculty, they cut staff, and they offload debt onto students' backs. That is unconscionable. You know, so this is what we face, right? Now, this is kind of where we have to move forward. And the question is that our faculty, not just at Kutztown University, but across the state system and other public sector unions are going to get this through our heads that we just have to, when administration tells us something, that we should start from the position that they're not telling us the truth, that they're lying. And force them to prove it otherwise. Accepting the goodwill of the administration is going to get us absolutely nowhere, everybody. Now, the one thing I have to say, this was a bit frustrating for me, right? So this Bunces, you know, we've planned Howard Bunces. I shouldn't say we. I mean, we at Kutztown, I mean. But, I mean, I didn't plan this visit. I was there reporting for Raging Chicken Press. But when this visit was planned for Howard Bunces, right, it was planned yesterday. It was planned beginning last December, I think, November or December. At the beginning of this semester, there was calls out to local media, to local elected officials and that kind of stuff. And you know what? We didn't have one person from the media there other than student media, right? We had the student newspaper who was there, and only one elected official showed up, right? And that representative was, kudos to him, is State Senator David Argel, who's a Republican, right? Now, again, invites went out to Judy Swank, invites went out to Mike Schlossberg, right? In some cases, you know, never heard back from these folks about whether or not they could come or if they had conflicts or what it might be. But what that message was to me, right? Look, an Argel is there. He's on, what did you say, Sean? He's on the Finance Committee?
Appropriations
Committee, right? So he's somebody that's part of this stuff. So kudos to him for at least showing up to see what this was all about, right? But what this shows us is that nobody will save us but ourselves, right? And this is no, I'm not saying that, like, you know, therefore, you know, Judy Swank is bad or Mike Schlossberg is bad. I don't agree with that at all. I think both of them are doing bang up jobs in so many different ways. But frankly, is this kind of stuff is not on the radar. It's not on a top priority list of elected officials. It's not on the top priority list of the media, right? The only people that are going to take this back and turn this tide are going to be faculty and students organizing. Faculty, students, and staff organizing, I should say. So that's it. You know, I mean, if there's any kind of lineup that we see, a kind of historic forces or perfect storms or things like this, is that we've got the Janus decision coming down from the Supreme Court at the same time that we see the sky is falling budgeting coming out of Pashi and Kutztown University. And the hope is that we're going to be able to shake ourselves out of the apathy, away from the fear, right, and step forward and fight back. And really, that was Bunces's message at the end of this. That's the only thing that is going to save it. It's the only thing that has ever saved labor. It is the only thing that has ever gotten us public education, is collective organizing and fighting back together. And what we saw, and I'm going to say this 1,000 times over before this is done, what we saw during the ABSCUF strike, right, in 2016, was that faculty, staff, and students were standing together, right, and basically saying, this is our campus. And we began to talk about and see what it might look like if we own this as our campus together and started having conversations about what we need to make this successful and not listen to the administration who consistently tries to pit us against each other, tries to tell faculty that, hey, listen, you know what? You better support that tuition hike because, you know, that's going to be your salary. If your tuition hike doesn't go up, guess what? That's going to come out of your hide. And then turns to students and says, like, you know, look, we don't want to give you a tuition hike. We don't want to increase these fees. But those faculty over there, they insist on having health care. They insist on having tenure. They don't want to be flexible. Right? And they look at the staff. I have to say this. How the staff are treated at Kutztown University is unconscionable. You go back and read some of the stuff that I reported on Raging Chicken Press before. It's unbelievable. Talk about that's not even a culture of fear. That's a culture of harassment. But so this is what we got. And so, look, we're in it together, folks, or we're going to get rolled, right? We're going to get rolled real hard. So that's my uplifting message for the day, Sean.
I was just letting you go.
Yeah, no, I know.
Check my Twitter feed as well.
Yeah, well, at least you know I've had a few hours since I left campus yesterday to actually tame my message because I was livid when I was leaving yesterday, and I told you, I said, you know what, I stopped at, you know, I mentioned at the beginning I was at, or I'll talk about this a little bit more in last call today, but I was at Saucony Creek yesterday and I just went there for lunch. I forgot my lunch. I usually bring my lunch. I forgot my lunch, and I was like a day just packed from about 6:30 in the morning straight through. And I forgot my lunch, and then it's like 2 o'clock. I'm done teaching. I said, I got to get something to eat before my union meeting. And so I went to Saucony Creek because it's right there in Kutztown, and said, you know, had the food there, and it was unbelievable. But I didn't have a beer there because I had meetings and things like this. But I bought kind of 2 bottles of kind of their barrel aged stuff, and a 4-pack. And I came home, and I was just like still fuming. I said, you know what? And I was exhausted. I'm like, okay, I've got a choice here. I got a choice. Either I could drink that beer, or I could go to sleep. And I chose sleep. So, and then I'm the better person for it this morning because I've had a little bit of perspective to try to think about what we need to do. So, and that. So that's what I got, Sean. That's what I got. Here we go. So, all right. And when we come back, we're going to get in the last call here. And we're going to try to keep with we'll call it the Sean tradition of we're going back with, you know, a little bit on the light side of things to kind of like mood enhancers after the break. If you're ready for that, everybody. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We want to remind you that you can support this work. You can support the work, the reporting that we do at RagingChickenPress.org by becoming a member. It's a little $5 a month. Become a member. Go to Patreon.com/RC Press. Patreon, PATREON.com/RC Press. When we come back, we're getting into Last Call. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 6 years, we've brought unapologetic, progressive, activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive, independent media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting, investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new, sustainable models of journalism. And frankly, no one's going to do it for us. After the Trump election, we dug in even deeper. Thanks to some longtime members, one-time donations, and a shift in other resources, we brought on more writers and started paying them. Now we're doubling down and want to expand our infrastructure and pay our writers even more. We need to invest in our media if we have a chance to resist the unprecedented assault on democracy, working families, women's rights, and our planet. History will remember the choices we make today. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a local craft beer or a cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways that you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support,
Keep up the fight.
Welcome back, everybody. It's time for the last call. We've got beer news. We've got space news. We got any other kind of fun thing that we want to throw in for the day. After we've kind of thrown ourselves down into the cauldron and the pit of despair, this is where the attempt to lift ourselves out by talking about things that generally are kind of fun. I just want to lead off. I get my space news out of the way. It's so interesting. I know Sean's yawning right there in the background already. He's taking his little nap before we get out of here. But it's been a really huge, huge week. I mean, this is after we saw what happened. We talked about this last week about the Falcon Heavy was launched. SpaceX launches Falcon Heavy. Now Elon Musk's Tesla Roadster is circulating around around the sun. Headed towards Mars, the asteroid belt, because they were offshot a little bit. They did come out this week and talk a little bit about what happened to that third rocket, the main booster. Basically, they found out that they actually underestimated the amount of fuelant that they would need for the reentry burn. So that's why it missed its target, they're saying. And then this week, there's been a series of rollout of announcements that SpaceX is building a second ship that they're going to be landing stuff on. There's also an uptick in activity in the space sector, space industry sector, and that kind of stuff. And all this by way of saying, there's a really good article it's come out in The Guardian. It's called The New Space Race, How Billionaires Launch the Next Era of Exploration. And I'll put this in the show notes for today. It's really, really worth a read. It's a reminder for me that, I really got to start writing about this on a regular basis. This actually came out a couple weeks ago. Came out last week. But it's a really good article kind of charting actually what's actually happening here in the space race. And let me see if I can pull this part up here. So let me just give you an example. I'm going to read a little bit from this article. It says, so the new space race is something stranger than the Cold War contest between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Government agencies like NASA, Roscosmos, and the European Space Agency have been collaborating with each other for decades, but they now face friendly competition and partnerships with corporations, which have their own long-term goals. Quote, what's new is that the companies themselves have ambitions beyond government contracts, says Casey Dreyer, director of space policy at the Planetary Society, an advocacy group. He compared it to the Gilded Age. When billionaires sought single-handedly to reshape the future, or at least the marketplace, for good or for ill. Quote, there's really no downside for NASA, he said. They've got this new capacity at their disposal and will be wiping away the drool thinking about all the opportunities they have for that rocket to reach out into other planets. Okay. So that gives you a little perspective of this Planetary Society when they talk about it as an advocacy group. But what they got right there is that this is precisely that is the comparison that we have. We're talking about the Gilded Age, right? And so remember, the Gilded Age, yes, was the Roosevelt era. Yes, was the kind of, the Carnegie Mellons. That was the, all these kind of famous, big people names that had billions and billions of dollars if you adjusted and that kind of stuff. And basically, it was also the time of the Lochner era and things like this, right, where you basically had where labor was being crushed, where people were being pushed out of the kind of democratic process, and that these folks rolled over our state, legislators, our Congress, in order to kind of increase their own wealth, because they were convinced that they knew best. And that is precisely what's going on here. So even for someone like me, who's kind of I have to always quell my own starry-eyed look as I'm kind of thinking about space exploration and all this kind of stuff. If you look who's lining up, man, Elon Musk, right? Jeff Bezos, right? These are the people who are already seeking to dominate markets here and to project. Now they're projecting their vision going forward. And what we find happening, and I've mentioned this last week, we find happening slowly and quietly behind the scenes, because not a lot of people pay attention to this stuff. The Trump administration, thanks to the fact that they've got Mike Pence at the spear of that, or the tip of that spear, have been basically slowly reforming space policy in order to open up privatization even more by things like, for example, privatizing the space station. Right, privatizing the space station and make our only kind of access to kind of near Earth orbit for long term to be a privately owned operation, which the government would lease, right, at the will of corporations. So as Sean would say, just let that sink in for a little bit. And maybe you can do that over a beer. I don't know. But you said, so I'll get off that. So you said I don't know if you want to comment on the space policy, but I know that, you know, Pizza Boy's got the Berliner Weiss is now canned this week, huh?
Yes. The Turkey Burglar is 3.5% and it's in cans, six packs and on draft.
Yeah, it's nice too. 3.5%. It's nice to have kind of like a good, nice, non-heavy beer out there right now too.
Yeah, I actually had something pretty fun this week.
Okay.
ACLU got back to me on my complaint that I filed about State Representative Daryl Metcalf blocking me on Facebook and Twitter.
Oh, do tell.
So I just have to send. Yeah, we talked for about like 20 minutes on the phone. He blocked me after I called him the white nationalist. It's the crack that keeps the Republicans keep on coming out and voting.
I don't think he just said that once either.
We documented our my experiences with Representative Metcalf over the past couple of years, going to the hearings, shooting protests outside his door, and also going to other legislative hearings and press conferences. And then, basically making the argument that they're blocking me as a member of the media. And I have to send them photos and videos and stuff like that of what's going on. So,
man, that's awesome. And you said this has been part of right that ACLU is actually looking to kind of really champion this case where we see that legislators are, you know, routinely now basically kind of trying to block people on Twitter. And
yes,
you know,
and also looking for complaints of state reps who have sent, or U.S. Congress reps, House Representative, House reps who have sent police notices to any of their constituents for calling in and making phone calls.
Oh man, this could get fun. This could get totally fun.
Yeah. So,
well, man, I tell you, this afternoon. So Free Will doesn't open until 3 o'clock today, but when they do, I am definitely heading to Free Will today. They've got have this new release, and as far as I can tell, it's never been out before. They might have been on tap before. I'm not sure, but this is the first time canning. It's called Orange Colored Malcontent. It's a double IPA with Caracara oranges, comes in at 9.5%. And I'm just going to read you. It's the normal release when they come out, the 16-ounce cans and four packs. So this is how they describe it. They say, this is a double IPA, was brewed with 120 pounds of fresh hand-squeezed Caracara oranges, leading to notes of refreshing citrus spritz, candied bitter orange peels, sweet orange blossoms, tangerine dreams, and orange cream soda, due in part to the addition of lactose. So that's going to be nice. A pleasantly firm hop bitterness provides an appropriate balance with some tropical fruit notes of pineapple juice, mango skin, and papaya. Hopped with Idaho 7, a Kuanot. I don't know how to say this. You know how to say that? E-K-U-A-N-O-T?
I got no clue.
Looks like Equinot. Equinot and Apollo. I don't know. So today, at 3 o'clock, the releases happen today. Both locations, both in Perkasie, their main one, and Peddler's Village, which they have a tasting room out there. So I'm psyched about that. Also this Sunday, February 18th, you got the whole kind of Mardi Gras thing that happened this past week and continuing now. And they're going to have the, basically a barrel age tap takeover at, Free Will this weekend. So they're going to have the Ralphius, is going to be there. They have a Trinity flight of basically 3 ounce pours of different, of 3 years. So you'll be able to get the 2015, the 2016 and the 2017, right? Taste the differences between those, 'cause there are some differences. So that's going to be pretty cool. You're also going to have a Belgian triple. It's a barrel, bourbon barrel age, bourbon barrel age Belgian triple, a rum barrel age spiced imperial brown called Special Cookie, apple brandy barrel age Belgian quad called Ella, which is also was released in bottles this year, which was fantastic. A rum barrel aged imperial brown ale with coffee called Brown Beard, and a Pinot Noir barrel aged barley wine, Bonesaw, and last but not least, a bourbon barrel aged Baltic Porter on Nitro. And that Baltic Porter just was put on tap this week. It's actually out there now too as well, and it's great. So the other cool thing is that if you know on Sundays that Down to Earth Cafe. The Down to Earth Cafe in Perkasie is going to be providing the food for Sunday. So if you're going to come out for that tap takeover, they're going to be there. Now, the guy who runs Down to Earth Cafe also runs the bakery in town called the Bread Box and Bakery. And they're fantastic too as well. But they've basically have teamed up with Free Will to basically produce beer bread. right? And they're releasing it only on Wednesdays. I got in touch with the owner, you know, back and forth through social media and stuff, and I was going to get some today. I wanted to be able to report on it. I said, nope, nope, sorry, only Wednesdays. And we kind of went fresh. We got fresh out of it pretty quickly. So that's pretty cool. So brown bread, it's kind of Free Will provide the grains for it. So they're kind of using stuff that's coming directly from Free Will, using it and kind of baking it in bread and releasing beer bread on Wednesday. So I'll let you know next week because I'm definitely getting out there. He said he put some aside for me too as well, so I could come pick it up next Wednesday. So I'll report on it next week. But, man, beer bread and beer, it's going to be, you know, it's a good thing, Sean. It's a good thing.
Nice.
Yeah, and last thing, I already mentioned this a little bit, but I just got to give a plug out again too as well. I had like I said, I went to lunch at Saucony Creek yesterday and they have salmon tacos, right? And they come to kind of two kind of small handheld tacos with fresh salmon, and it's just unbelievable. I mean, it's the kind of stuff, and they make their own hot sauce there, so you put that on, and it just every single time I go there and have the food, I am just like floored. Right. And which, again, that's why they call it a brewery and gastropub there. And so you have locally sourced ingredients. You have, you know, a sustainably sourced ingredients there. So I'm telling you, if you're ever in Kutztown and you're looking for a good place to eat, you want to have a beer with you or not, like you don't need to, go check out Saucony Creek and just, you know, order anything on that menu. Right. I would recommend whatever they have. They just changed up. They used to have like a couple of weeks back, last time I was there, they had a Thai shrimp taco. The salmon has now replaced that. The menu is always changing. They have these kind of homemade mushroom pierogies that they have on the menu kind of fairly often, which are out of this world, and hand cut French fries, which you just can't beat. So that's my plug for Saucony Creek this week.
Nice.
Yeah. Anything else for the good of the order this week, Sean?
No, nothing else really going on. Just getting ready to work all weekend.
Yeah. Well, man, good luck with that. I'm going to go. I've got a bunch of student papers coming in this weekend, so it's going to be a grading weekend for me. although I am going to make it out to my wife and I and my brother-in-law and sister-in-law are going out to dinner tomorrow night for the first time in a while. So that's going to be good. So at least we'll have one night kind of out. And I'll report on that because I'm sure from what I looked at the menu, there's some good beer on tap. So I'll report back on that next week. All right, nice. Man. Well, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. And, of course, we've got Sean Kitchen. I'll talk to you next week, Sean.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right, man. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Do not forget, become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Patreon.com/RC Press. Until next week, everybody, keep the fight up. See ya.
Like, I want to know who manufactured this gun. Now, for some reason, it doesn't seem to be any reporting about that. All the big gun manufacturers have their version of an AR-15. But I want to know who specifically did this one. I want to be able to send the CEO a card saying, congratulations on your weapon doing such a good job at shredding these high school students. Congratulations on your weapon doing such a good job in killing that toddler. Congratulations on your weapon being able to rip apart the vital organs of that football coach at the high school, of that sociology teacher. I'd like to be able to send a card to the members of the board of directors of that company and just compliment them. Compliment them on the quality of their product.